Welcome to the BizNews Bulletin and thank you for joining us. I'm Lucy Ferreira, Executive Producer for BizNews.com. It is Wednesday, the 29th of June, and we're coming to you from an icy Johannesburg. We have an intriguing lineup of insights and analysis from the belly of the BizNews studios today. Starting off, we'll have a market overview from Alec Hogg, followed by a brand new snapshot of an informative interview that Alec had yesterday with one of BizNews' favourite value investors, Pitful Yun from Counterpoint Asset Management. For those of you that have been following the Zondo Commission's report on the state capture, we have an exclusive from BizNews' own Mike Apple on the Astina dairy travesty. Mike is an expert on the matter, having followed the saga since it began in 2018. And finally, we'll be closing up the bulletin with the daily news update from the Financial Times in London. Please remember that these interviews have been shortened to give you brief insights for the day. And if you'd like to hear more, subscribe to our channels on Spotify and YouTube, and be sure to check out biznews.com. And now it's over to Alec for an update on the market.
Good morning. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com. NASDAQ composite down by 3% last night, S&P 500 down 2%, and that after a reasonable start to the session. The reason for this is consumer confidence numbers came out and they weren't good. Overall, there have been some pretty sharp declines. A couple of our favorites, Apple and Microsoft, down 3%. Yesterday, we added Amazon to the BizNews portfolio, and that went down by 5%. So hopefully you bought yours last night late into the session and got yourself what could be a bargain, but who knows? The S&P 500 index, this is the index that looks at the overall United States market, that is heading for its worst performance since 1970. That's like 50 years. The worst first half of any year since 1970. And that has got some people saying, like Howard Marks we heard from earlier in this week, one of the investment gurus in the United States, saying that surely the bottom has to be reached sometime very soon. Well, the insiders are telling us that the bottom will only be reached after we see inflation in the United States stabilizing, or at least that it has peaked, and economic data showing that the country is not going into a recession. So why are consumers in America so unhappy? According to the data that was released yesterday, which gave the market such a jolt, it's because of concerns over interest rates rising and inflation going high. So those two issues then really combine quite nicely. You can understand that those looking for a bottom in the market are saying interest rates and economic data have got to look up, and if consumers are thinking the same way as well. As far as the rest of the markets are concerned, the Rand lost 24 cents against the US dollar yesterday at 16 Rand and 7 cents and 18 cents against the British pound. It's sitting at 19 Rand 61. It's this flight to safety that one sees. On a day-to-day basis, though, the markets are really turbulent at the moment, and don't get too upset or excited about them. It is a period that we're going through right now where volatility is high. Bitcoin expresses that volatility very closely. You remember a little while ago, there was reports that we spoke about on BizNews from Vinnie Lingham, a South African who's regarded as something of a digital guru in California. Vinnie said that if Bitcoin held $20,000, then that was likely to be the foundation for an improvement. However, if it fell below $20,000, watch out. Well, it's getting perilously close to that number, down by 2% last night, and Bitcoin trading at the moment at 20,283, so not much of a margin there. The Geltech basket, as a consequence of that decline, was down by 1%, and the gold price down $6 overnight to $1,821 at the moment. Here in South Africa, on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, there was a better performance. And this despite the fact that the big boost that we saw on Monday, coming from Prosus and Naspers with that sensational announcement that we spoke about a lot yesterday and covered on BizNews yesterday. Well, they've now eased back a little bit. You'll get reason for that from Pitful Yun later in the show this morning. He reckons that the turnaround that they enjoyed that 20% jump on Monday, is it he doesn't see too much of a further narrowing in the discount between Naspers Truck Process and its shareholding in Tencent, and he explains it quite well. I apologize for the sound quality. It's not our usual, up to our usual sound, but Pitt was caught a little unawares by my call, and he wasn't near his usual microphone. But anyway, you can hear him clearly enough, and it's well worth persevering. He is incidentally going to be at the BizNews conference coming up 30th of August to the 2nd of September. And if you haven't got tickets, the good news is that we have had a few cancellations. People who booked immediately after the previous conference are no longer able to make it. So there are a few rooms available in the hotel itself and, of course, up the road at the Champagne Castle Hotel. But that's an aside. Getting back to what happened in the local markets, despite the inability of Naspers to follow through with the big surge that we saw on Monday. Indeed, the Naspers price was down by 2% yesterday, 2,300 Rand a share, and a little bit of pressure on some of the banking shares. First Rand down by almost 2%. That's trading now at 60 Rand a share. The market overall was up, helped there by minerals and metal stocks. Glencore continues to run. That's 2.5% higher at just over 90 Rand a share. And we also saw Sasol stabilizing. It was 370 Rand a share. And Pitt says this is going to be a trend that we'll see into the future. So an interesting story that you're going to be listening to from Pitt Fullion in a moment. We did add Absa to our portfolio yesterday, and it actually went up on the day. Now, this doesn't happen too often when we put shares in our model portfolio, but this one went up by 1.25%. To 160 Rand a share. We really like Absa, but so does Pitt. So you'll get that insight as well from him a little later. Also coming up in the program is my colleague Mike Apple, who is a bit of a Zondo Commission expert, and he's done a lovely explainer on what's going on with the Estina Dairy. Now, those of you who followed my career know that I grew up in Newcastle in KwaZulu-Natal, northern KwaZulu-Natal, and our closest town was a place in the Free State called Meermal. And Meermal, its closest town is Vrede. So it's at Vrede where the Estina Dairy and the Guptas got busy. So it's kind of a little bit of hometown stories for me. Very interesting story, which I've been following, and Michael unpacks it beautifully for us. That comes up later in the program. Also coming up in the show today, the Financial Times of London gives us their morning bulletin. And there, they're talking about Donald Trump. Get this. On the 6th of January, when you had all those crazy guys who were storming the Capitol in Washington, Trump wanted to join them. He tried to commandeer the limo. And this is in evidence that was given yesterday in the U.S. He tried to commandeer the limo, and it was only because the Secret Service guys around him refused to let the effing president, as he called himself, take over the vehicle, that Trump wasn't in the vanguard of the guys with the bison heads and all kinds of crazy markings or strange markings on their bodies who stormed. I'm sure you'll all remember that, the Capitol in the US at that time. So the FT gives us that story. It also talks about the whole issue on abortion now getting to a different level, where mail order abortion pills are becoming a pretty contentious subject now in the US, because with the end of Roe v. Wade, there was a decision many years ago that abortion in America was allowed on demand. That has now been overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, which was packed by conservative judges by Donald Trump. So now that overturning has seen great outpouring of unhappiness in the United States, and they're already pretty fractious over there. And coming into that scenario is the perspective of what happens with mail order abortion pills if you are in a state which bans abortion on demand, but how are you going to stop these guys getting the abortion pills? A fascinating subject. They also have some other issues as well that they'll be telling us about, including in the UK, how facial recognition is now becoming a hot topic. If you go around the UK, you'll see cameras pretty much everywhere. This is done to fight crime. I'm talking about the UK cities. Now they want to stop this on the basis of privacy.
Next up, we have Alex's interview with Pitful Yun.
I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com. Pitful Yun, portfolio manager at Counterpoint and star attraction at the BizNews conference, which, jeepers, Pete, it's just around the corner now.
No, it's not that far away. And when it comes, it'll be spinning as well, which is nice.
August the 30th until September the 2nd. And you're going to be engaged in a debate, which should be real interesting. But I wanted to ask you a little about your bundles.
Yes, my bundle of strength, my bundle of strength.
Are you going to have some more bundles to, or another bundle to share with us?
Yeah, I'll have some more twigs to share, not a whole bundle. The whole bundle is a portfolio, as it stands, but I definitely have some more twigs to share with you.
Now, I've got to ask you about one in particular. Today, I had the BizNews model portfolio update and decided to sell Avenge to go for another one of your favorite stocks, Transaction Capital, and Absa, which was recommended by Koki Koyman. But the reason I decided to do that was because of feedback I was getting on Moorman's, which wasn't very good, which was one of the reasons why Avenge was an appealing stock for some people. What's your view? Is it used to be one of your twigs. I know you've done very well out of it. Is it still there?
It's still there. I haven't sold it yet. I actually haven't. I haven't been buying any of it either. But I still think it's undervalued, and in a portfolio context, I think it still makes a lot of sense. So I still own it, and we'll see what happens going forward.
What happens with those twigs of yours? When do you decide to take them out of your portfolio?
It's one of two things. Either they get fully valued and you sell them, or the second thing, you get an opportunity to buy something better or cheaper. And then it's a relative argument you have to make. So it's generally one of those two things that causes me to sell one of my twigs. Doesn't happen very often, though. Transactional activity in the portfolio is quite low.
So do you actually, just help us here on how the experts or the professionals do it. Do you do your analysis and put a valuation on a particular stock, and then as long as it stays below that valuation, stay with it?
Yeah. Look, I try and steer clear of a specific point in time single valuation number. I think the value of any business is very much a gray area and depends on prospects. It depends on the environment. It depends on management actions at any particular point in time. So there's a whole bunch of variables go into it, and these change on a regular basis. So, you know, as long as the stock is within that broad gray area of being undervalued, in other words, there is upside going forward, then I will continue to hold it. As long as that upside pays you for the risk you're taking on owning a stock. Because when you own the stock of any business, you're taking on business risk, that company's specific business risk. Whether it's NASPAS or whether it's Avenge, you are taking on, you take on some sort of risk. I mean, that's why you invest. You investing is taking on risks that you think you're being paid to take on. And that's effectively the definition of investing. So as long as it's in that gray area, where, in my estimation, I'm being paid for owning the risk of that business, I'll continue to hold on it.
You mentioned NASPAS, a big announcement yesterday, and long overdue, some money managers would recommend. What's your thoughts on it?
Look, I mean, there's positives and negatives. I think they are doing the right thing in principle by trying to narrow the discount in this fashion. They need to narrow the discount. They need to take action to narrow the discount. Everything they've done up to now has just served to widen the discount, to complicate matters, and has been highly ineffective. And one can understand why they would do that, because they were incentivized to do other things. They weren't incentivized to narrow the discount. However, I think a better way of narrowing the discount would be to unbundle the 10 cent share to their shareholders and get on with a pure play venture capital investing firm, which is what they are doing. They're just using the cash flow of the Tencent to subsidize that activity. I think shareholders would rather want to choose whether they want to own a high-quality business like Tencent, which generates lots of cash, albeit out of China with its own set of circumstances, set of risks, and or a portfolio of venture capital loss-making businesses, which might turn into something substantial in the future, but at the moment they are loss-making. You know, I think investors probably don't want the mix of those two things. They probably would. Some would prefer Tencent, others would prefer the venture capital portfolio. So the right thing to do to unlock or to narrow the discount would be to unbundle the Tencent shares, and then you will get a fair value for the venture capital portion of the business.
Interestingly, looking at it from the other perspective and the argument that we heard from Bob van Dijk yesterday, it's almost like they've now got this treasure chest of $140 billion that had been frozen in the past. They weren't allowed to sell the Tencent shares. Now they can sell them, and they can sell them at any rate that they want to. They say responsibly, but I guess if they got a good opportunity or if somebody knocked on the door and said, we want to buy $20 billion worth of stock, they'd be able to do that. And by using that money to acquire assets in a market where the assets are suddenly so much cheaper would seem to be a good call. But I guess you'd have views on that as well.
Yeah, my view is that I'm not a venture capital investor. I don't know how those things work. I'm a late stage equity investor, and those are the sort of assets I'm comfortable with. I think if that's what management wants to do, buy venture capital loss making businesses, which they hope to grow into profitable dominant businesses, then they must do it. Then they must unbundle the Tencent and carry on with their venture capital investing. To sell a great cash generating business to redeploy that capital into loss-making early-stage businesses, I'm not sure that's what investors want. That's maybe what Bob wants, but I'm not sure that's what investors want.
So the big increase in the share price yesterday, on average 20% for both Naspers and Prosus, that wouldn't be drawing you into buying those shares now?
No, I think the 20% increase is fully justified by the actions they're taking to narrow the discount. The discount was very, very wide, and it was saying that these guys aren't going to be able to narrow the discount. They obviously now have shown the market that they at least partially want to close the discount. The market has rewarded them for that. But I think that's about it. You're still sitting with a business which is selling its crown jewel to invest into what might or might not be future crown jewels. Where, you know, the jury's still out on those.
So it's not something that you'd be jumping into right now.
It's not something that excites me now.
At the last BizNews conference, Stafford Marcy gave, I thought, a very compelling argument for Bitcoin. We've spoken about this in the past, and I remember you saying that as an insurance, you should have a few percent, a couple of percent really. I think it was 2 or 3% you were talking about in your portfolio. Given what's happened with cryptocurrencies recently, would you still be of that opinion?
Yeah, I'm still of that opinion. One doesn't know the future, and as long as you aren't over-allocated to Bitcoin or any of its derivatives or stablemates on the blockchain, I think that's fine. I think 2 to 3% is a lot. I would say, whatever you're comfortable with in terms of the possibility of losing everything. I mean, it could go to zero. So if you're comfortable losing 10% of your assets, you can comfortably own 10% of your assets in Bitcoin. Whatever you're comfortable losing, or whatever is not going to cause you sleepless nights, you know, that's the number you should be investing in, with the knowledge that it could go to zero, or it could go to a big number, or it could do nothing. You know, you just don't know. But it seems to me that the technology behind Bitcoin and Ethereum and all these things, there are a lot of smart people spending a lot of money trying to come up with use cases that could benefit consumers globally. And if that happens, then there's tremendous upside.
Please enjoy Mike Apple's chilling analysis on the Astina dairy case.
How a Gupta company with 16 Rand in its bank account scored 280 million Rand. An IT guy with no dairy farming experience was the face of a Gupta company, Istina, that had less than 20 Rand in its bank account when it got its first prepayment of 30 million Rand from Free State coffers. Istina, through its frontman Kamal Vasram, a guy who worked retail for the Gupta Sahara Computers, was paid 280 million Rand in 8 payments between July 2012 and May 2016 to run a dairy farm in the eastern Free State town of Vrede. The project had noble intentions, on paper anyway: bring together about 100 beneficiaries from the local community, give them 10 dairy cows each, make them 51% shareholders in the project, and let it flourish as a milk processing hub. When the Free State Government's Executive Committee, the EXCO, convened on 29 February 2012 to discuss the idea of a dairy parlor and processing plant in Vrede, the projected cost of the project was 13 million rand. The project's quantum ballooned to an astonishing 572 million rand once politicians and the Guptas got their claws into it. It was supposed to be a public-private partnership that would see over half a billion rand pumped into the venture, with 228 million rand meant to come from Istina as the implementing agent itself and the rest from the government. It's important to note here that there was never any feasibility study done on the project. No business plan, no environmental impact assessment, no water rights, no competitive tender process followed, and the venture was not budgeted for. When a feasibility study was eventually done, Gupta acolyte Iqbal Sharma, through his company Nulane Investments, was paid 25 million rand to do it. Sharma subcontracted to Deloitte for 1.5 million rand and redirected the rest of the money to a host of Gupta companies, including Island Sight Investments. It's in connection with this case of fraud and money laundering that Atul and Rajesh Gupta were recently arrested in Dubai. On 7 June 2012, Free State Agriculture Head of Department Peter Tabete signed an agreement with Istina. It was very short-lived, as the state law advisors quickly pointed out that it was irregular and flouted procurement processes. On 5 July 2012, a second agreement with Istina was signed. Just 4 days later, on the 9th of July, a prepayment of 30 million rand landed in Istina's bank account. Without lifting a finger, the Guptas had begun their plunder of provincial resources, using poor black farmers as the face of their systematic looting. What necessitated the downfall of the project was just how badly it was run, which started to attract attention. Vasram had no idea what he was doing on the farm. He ran the dairy so badly, in fact, that cows were dying at an alarming rate and being dumped in a nearby ravine with potentially catastrophic environmental consequences. Istina hardly spent any of its newfound wealth on actually running the farm, let alone buying feed for the animals. Worse, the intended beneficiaries were completely sidelined and strung along by authorities for years. Their poverty was used as the front for the project, while the money was siphoned out the back. In total, Istina had 891.8 million rand flow through its bank account destined for the Gupta's offshore washing machine that laundered the funds. After unwanted media scrutiny, the Istina agreement was cancelled on 13 August 2014, just over 2 years after the project began. Logically, one would think that closed the money taps on the project, but you'd be wrong. State Capture Inquiry Chairperson Raymond Zondo's report notes that Istina continued to receive payments from the Department of Agriculture and Rural Development until 2016. On the basis of an unsubstantiated claim by the HOD of the department, Mr. Tabete, that Istina had met key deliverables under the contract. No evidence to this effect could be provided.
Good morning from the Financial Times. Today is Wednesday, June 29th, and this is your FT News Briefing. Access to mail-order abortion pills is a new front in the U.S. legal battle over abortion. In the U.K., there's a new call to ban live facial recognition technology in public areas. And the war in Ukraine has roiled another global industry, the timber trade. I'm Jess Smith, in for Mark Filippino, and here's the news you need to start your day. There was a stunning moment in Washington yesterday. At U.S. congressional hearings into the January 6th attack on the Capitol, lawmakers heard testimony from a former White House aide. She said that former President Trump tried to commandeer the presidential limousine in an effort to join rioters who were attacking the Capitol. Secret Service stopped him. Here's the former aide, Cassidy Hutchinson.
The president said something to the effect of, "I'm the effing president, take me up to the Capitol now." To which Bobby responded, "Sir, we have to go back to the West Wing." The president reached up towards the front of the vehicle to grab at the steering wheel. Mr. Engel grabbed his arm, said, "Sir, you need to take your hand off the steering wheel."
Hutchinson also testified that Trump demanded that his armed supporters be let into his rally before marching to the Capitol. The goal of the hearings is to reconstruct what happened when a pro-Trump mob attacked the Capitol building last January to try and block the certification of presidential election winner Joe Biden. In the UK today, an independent legal expert is issuing a study urging the government to ban live facial recognition in public spaces until there are laws to regulate its use. Here's our European technology correspondent, Marumita Mergia.
So really, there are two primary concerns. One is that it's inaccurate, and in particular, experiments have shown that live facial recognition doesn't work as well on female faces and darker skinned faces. And partly, you know, this is a solvable technical problem, but also partly scientists don't really know why this is the case. But while they're trying to figure it out, the technology is already being deployed and rolled out on the streets by people like the Metropolitan Police in London. So really the big concern there is not only that it can get it wrong, but also that it can be discriminatory and biased in the process.
Madhu, what kind of laws could address these issues?
At the moment, we have privacy and data protection laws like the GDPR across Europe and the UK's version. We also have human rights laws and laws around equality and, you know, non-discrimination. But this review found that when you look across the spectrum of these laws, none of them really address the primary issue here, which is whether facial recognition is fit for public use or not, which is why he recommended that there need to really be completely new laws written and then a kind of patchwork of regulation put in around it.
So compared to other countries, where does the UK stand in terms of regulating government use of facial recognition technology?
So in the US, it's happened on a sort of state-by-state level or city-by-city. So, for example, San Francisco and Oakland have both said that they will do a temporary ban of the technology, live facial recognition, until there's proper legislation or regulation in place. The EU is in the process of writing a brand new law called the AI Act, which will look at kind of regulating lots of different parts of artificial intelligence. So it's a good time for the UK to kind of be a pioneer in this area, because we're also rewriting here in the UK the data laws, because we've separated out from the European Union. And so the UK government is actually in the process of rewriting all its data protection laws. So it'd be kind of timing-wise a good time to also look in parallel at biometrics.
Marumita Mergia is the FT's European technology correspondent. Another economic casualty of the war in Ukraine has been the global trade in timber. Western sanctions have disrupted not only Russian timber exports.
Russia is the world's largest softwood timber exporter, and together with Ukraine and Belarus, which is also subject to sanctions, the three countries make up about a quarter of the global trade, so it's a really significant amount.
That's the FT's Madeline Speed. She reports that some countries plan to increase logging to make up for the shortfall, and that's a worry to environmentalists.
So in Ukraine, when the war broke out, there was basically a new law introduced, which was part of the kind of martial law, which basically said that they would lift restrictions on felling, because usually they'd basically stop all felling during the spring and summer seasons to protect the kind of animal wildlife in the forests. And the idea is that they'll be able to increase the supply, you know, for the war effort, but then also longer term in order to boost export earnings. but it means that the forests are going to be hit. And forests obviously are critical to storing and removing carbon from the atmosphere. 100 world leaders pledged to halt deforestation by 2030. So there's just not a lot of wiggle room for these countries to start increasing logging while kind of sticking to their obligations.
That's the FT's Madeline Speed. In the U.S., demand for abortion pills has surged since the country's highest court last week struck down the constitutional right to abortion. Now, access to these medications through telehealth is becoming a new legal battleground. Our U.S. pharmaceutical correspondent, Jamie Smith, joins me to talk more about this. Hi, Jamie.
Oh, good morning.
So how big is the increase in demand for abortion pills?
So we spoke to three of these telehealth abortion providers, Hey Jane, Just the Pill, and Aid Access. And they said that they had received a twofold, a fourfold, and a fivefold increase in inquiries and, in some cases, patient demand and requests following the Supreme Court ruling on Friday, you know, which overturned Roe versus Wade. Because what that judgment did was it triggered laws banning or severely restricting abortion in at least 13 states across the US. So that's left people looking for alternative ways to seek abortion care.
So what are abortion opponents doing in response to this, or what are they planning to do?
Now, during the COVID pandemic, US federal regulators authorized telehealth providers to post pills directly to women's homes with no need to visit a doctor or a pharmacist in person. Now, because of the increase in the use of abortion pills, you've seen conservative anti-abortion campaigners and Republican lawmakers pass laws in Republican-controlled legislatures across the US, which seek to severely restrict and, in some cases, completely ban access to these telehealth mail-order-style abortions.
And how would they enforce these laws?
It's going to be extremely difficult to do that. It's really difficult to search through the mail. In fact, it possibly could be illegal because in the US, mail between states is a federal responsibility and there's probably far too much volume to check every package. And actually, one of the providers, Aid Access, has said that it will continue to post pills into these states where there are specific bans. So it's, in a sense, saying it's going to flout the existing rules. So I think that issue of enforcement will probably be really important as we go forward.
Are there challenges to these efforts to block access to abortion pills? I mean, what have abortion rights supporters done legally?
One of the makers of the abortion pill, it's actually suing Mrs. Zippy over restrictions that it has attempted to introduce back in 2020 on medication abortion. This is looking like it's going to be a real test case as to whether the US Food and Drug Administration rules on ensuring access to these abortion pills will be upheld. On the day that Roe versus Wade was overturned, the Attorney General, Merrick Garland, released a statement saying that regulators at the FDA have approved the use of the abortion pill and that US states may not ban the medicine. But what we don't know is exactly how they're going to try and prevent these state bans from going ahead. But certainly what we're going to see is a huge legal fight over this in the months and probably years to come.
Jamie Smith is our US pharmaceutical correspondent. Jamie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can read more on all these stories at FT.com. This has been your daily FT News Briefing. Make sure you check back tomorrow for the latest business news.
And that's all from the Biz News Bulletin today. Thank you for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. This helps our ratings, and it ensures that we can continue to bring you quality news, analysis, and insight.